Morning. We're delighted to welcome you for our second case today, and where we have two high school groups and one college group. Would the Edgerton High School students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Would the Lancaster High School group please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Will the Ripon College pre-law students stand? You've been introduced once, now you're introduced twice. Thank you for coming. You may be seated, please. The high school students are here with a program cleverly entitled Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program sponsored by the state bar in this court. Students are invited to come, listen to an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, material is sent about the case that they will hear, and they may engage in some activities related to that case. When they come to court, they have the opportunity after this second case to meet with a justice who has been assigned for that day to meet with students. And the discussion will be about the procedures that the court uses in taking a case and deciding a case. There will be no discussion of the substantive issues of the case. Everybody here is invited to join the students and the justice at the lunch hour. Is there anyone here who wishes a summary of the case? If you raise your right hand carefully, and we'll give you a summary. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He will meet with the Ripon College pre-law students in the reading room of the court, which is on the ground level at 16 East. The marshal will help the students find that room if there's any difficulty. The Edgerton High School students, the Lancaster High School students, and the Prairie du Chien High School students, if they're still here, will meet with me in this courtroom right after this hearing. So, got it? Ripon, Gableman, everyone else, Abrahamson. By the way, I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And Michael Gableman is on my far left. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. Having made those introductions, I'll call our next case, which is 09AP2934CR, State versus Deandra A. Buchanan. Arguing on behalf of the defendant is Tyler William Wickham, and we will then hear from Assistant Attorney General Thomas Bellasperi, arguing for the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Wickham.
Please the court. My name is Tyler Wickman. I represent Mr. Buchanan in this case. The main issue in this case is whether, under the totality of the circumstances, Trooper Randy Gordon, based on specific and articulable facts, had a reasonable suspicion Mr. Buchanan was armed, dangerous, and had immediate access to weapons. This cannot be based on an unparticularized or inchoate suspicion or hunch. Must be based on facts, and we must look at the totality of all the circumstances. The goal here is to strike a balance between the state's interest in protecting law enforcement, which is a valid interest, and with an individual's constitutional right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. In the facts of this case, Mr. Buchanan was stopped at approximately 9:37 p.m. on an interstate highway. He was driving alone. At the time he was stopped, which is not an issue in this case, it is conceded he was speeding, Trooper Gordon turned on his lights and shined a spotlight to the back window. He immediately observed Mr. Buchanan weave within his lane, an up-and-down movement with his arm that appeared to be below the seat, but otherwise the car stopped in the normal amount of time for a vehicle traveling nearly 80 miles per hour.
Is there any evidence that this area of the interstate, which is, what, between Minneapolis, St. Paul, and wherever, east, is a traffic lane for movement of drugs?
I don't believe that was in the record. It is an interstate highway that is readily traveled by all sorts of individuals. I think you can infer that drugs travel on it just as well as everyday individuals.
As well as justices.
As well as justices, yes.
Okay.
It was near Osseo, Wisconsin as well, which is near Eau Claire but somewhat rural. Immediately after stopping, Trooper Gordon approached the vehicle and he noticed a shaking hand. He felt this was unusual nervousness, although Trooper Gordon had never met Mr. Buchanan before, knew nothing about him, but did notice a shaking hand. He had a conversation with Mr. Buchanan, advised him he was stopped for speeding. There's a conversation where Mr. Buchanan advised him that his speedometer wasn't working, and he was on his way to visit his daughter in Minneapolis. By all accounts, other than a shaking hand, it was a very uneventful encounter. There was no signs of hostility, no signs of intoxication. It seemed very uneventful, and Mr. Buchanan was cooperative. Upon returning to his cruiser, Trooper Gordon ran a license and discovered that Mr. Buchanan had been arrested in the past for crimes that included murder, false imprisonment, and armed robbery. The only other information concerning those arrests were that they were from Minnesota and North Dakota. Dates, dispositions, underlying facts, nothing else was known by the officer.
Nothing about the dates?
Not of those charges.
Mm-hmm.
There was, he also learned that there was a pending drug delivery charge of THC specifically from that same region through State Patrol. It was unknown what court, if a court. It was a pending charge, though, not an arrest. He said pending charge. No indications of whether bond was set, no information really other than it was from a couple weeks prior and it was pending in that region of the state and it was specific to delivery of THC, not other drugs, but specifically THC.
May I ask, is there any question at all about whether the purported arrests for homicide and false imprisonment applied to this specific individual?
Could you repeat that again?
Is there any dispute that the prior arrest applied to this specific individual?
No. There was no dispute at the motion hearing or in the record regarding whether Mr. Buchanan had, in fact, been arrested for those crimes. It was reported that to the trooper that he had been, and based on the record, we've accepted that as an undisputed fact.
I don't know this. Does the record provide some documentary evidence of exactly what the officer knew?
He ran through his own computer checking for criminal history, and he contacted dispatch. Dispatch sent to him via the computer, not the airwaves, a positive criminal history, which indicated arrests for the charges. But there was no other information concerning the arrests, just that they were, in fact, arrests.
And no dates?
No dates. The locations were supplied as Minnesota and North Dakota, but it wasn't even distinguished of the murder, false imprisonment, and armed robbery charges, what states those belong to. Is just those three, went to Minnesota, North Dakota, no other information, and then a pending delivery of THC charge in that region of the state that was a couple weeks prior. So we did have somewhat of a date on that.
You're not saying that a law enforcement officer shouldn't check
or run someone's record when they're checking on their license, right?
Not at all. They absolutely should.
Okay. What should they do when they get hits back, when they get information back saying prior, because they don't sift out whether it's an arrest or a conviction or a pending charge. They just get a run of who they've got in front of them. What should they do with that information? Ignore it?
They should not ignore it. I believe it is a factor under the totality of the circumstances. I think the issue is how much weight should be given to that factor, and part of that weight goes to how much information is being provided to them. A positive history with a conviction is certainly more noteworthy than an arrest. A conviction of battery to a law enforcement officer would show a past history of being violent towards law enforcement. But we have more information there. We have very vague information in this case. It was just an arrest. We don't even know what happened from those arrests. He could have never been charged, could have been dismissed, could have been acquitted.
So in this instance, what should law enforcement have done with this information, or not done?
I believe they should have made at least an attempt to inquire further. There was a period of time.
With who?
With dispatch.
Okay. To do what? What if dispatch said, what difference does it make if there are convictions? Is that the test that you want us to use? If there are convictions, law enforcement can go further. If they're just pending or if they're only arrests, then they can't. I just want to figure out exactly what it is you, because we need to give law enforcement their tool. Whatever it is, we need to be clear. Here's what you can do, here's what you can't do. So what is it exactly?
Again, they can use everything under the totality of the circumstances, and it should be a factor they consider. But if they inquire and they learn that it is a conviction, more weight could possibly be given to that. We have a 26-year-old here where, with these serious offenses, if he's free on a murder charge, presumably if he was guilty, he would have been in prison. That's a reasonable inference to draw from just him being free.
Can I just, have to interrupt you. We have to focus, it seems to me, on what this evidence or what these items are being submitted for. The issue in this case, as I understand it, and you should correct me if I'm wrong, is was there reasonable suspicion to frisk him, right?
I believe that is the
issue. That's one issue. Reasonable suspicion to frisk. So we've got to get, it seems to me, all of these items focusing on do they give reasonable suspicion to believe that he's armed and a danger to the officer. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. The second part of this, it seems to me, but I think they meld, and I'm not sure how they meld, is does he have reasonable suspicion or what are the grounds he needs to frisk the car? Right?
Correct.
All right. So let's just take the search and what he's got, the frisking, I'm sorry, of the person. The officer may think he's got drugs. Does he have a right to frisk for drugs?
No, he
does not.
Reasonable
suspicion? Okay. He has probable cause, maybe, right? Maybe. But reasonable suspicion. So what do these items of arrest and the pending drug delivery, how do they, in the totality of the circumstances, move the officer to have reasonable suspicion that that this man is armed or dangerous?
Well, the officer...
I misstated the test.
No, I don't believe you have. I think you've accurately and correctly stated the test.
All right.
The officer implied that drugs equal guns, a pending drug charge on the same highway, I believe is the state's argument, could reasonably infer that he's doing this behavior again. I see this as a past charge. There was only a up and down movement with the arm, reaching under a seat. That could be inferred he was putting something there. It could also be any number of anarchist movements that this court highlighted in the State v. Johnson decision, where it stated, you know, movement alone is not enough. People make those movements every time. And if we look at the movement in this case, it would happen right after the lights came on, right as the spotlight came on. He could have been startled. There's a number of movements that could have happened, but he didn't delay stopping his car. He immediately stopped his car. So we have to look at that movement and what suspicion may be attached to it in the totality of the circumstances. Going back to the arrest or the pending drug charge, he was suspected maybe even of having probable cause of drugs in the past. There wasn't a suspicion that he now had drugs, and noteworthy from that, there was no apparent weapon charges. It was strictly a pending marijuana charge. It is a
drug. But he had an arrest for armed robbery. That sounds like he's got a weapon. He has an arrest for murder. Now, he could have been driving the car when the other guy did the murder, but there's enough there to say this guy has got violence in his record.
Well, we don't know enough about those arrests to give much weight to them. I'm agreeing that they can be considered, but without more information, little weight should be given to them is my position. If we look at the State v. Eason case, on a no-knock search warrant, it was conceded there's probable cause that cocaine existed in a home, and two individuals were dealing drugs in the home. But this court found the affidavit for a no-knock warrant insufficient based on, one, drugs equal guns, which, although the court acknowledged is that drugs and guns often go together, versus the Wisconsin makes it so that there's no bright-line rule that drugs equal guns. Then they looked at the arrest history of those individuals. One had aggravated assault that was 10 years old out of Illinois. There was also, he was arrested days prior, unknown what for. And then the other person in the home had 14 arrests that included assaults, included obstructing officers. And the standard on a no-knock search warrant is very similar. It's reasonable suspicion whether executing the search warrant and announcing their presence would be dangerous to the law enforcement or would result in the destruction of evidence.
Counselor, isn't there, though, a real difference in our jurisprudence when we analyze a case involving an automobile and an officer's interaction with the automobile and a case where we're looking at officers' entry into someone's home?
There are differences between the two, certainly.
And isn't the home protected to a greater degree than an automobile generally is?
It is, but when we look at specifically the Eason decision, they already have probable cause and cause to enter the home. The issue with using the arrest records in that case for the no-knock announcement is there's already a diminished expectation of privacy because police can lawfully enter. It's just whether they let you know they're coming in or not.
That was a warrant case. Eason was a warrant, right?
Excuse me?
Eason was a warrant
case. It was a warrant case.
And wasn't the holding that the affidavit in support of the warrant wasn't good enough to establish reasonable suspicion that no knock was authorized?
That's correct, but there was still probable cause to enter.
There was probable cause to enter. There was probable cause to get a warrant. Obviously, they did get a warrant. But they had to follow. The warrant was not good enough for no knock. Was that it?
That is correct.
Okay.
And the reason it wasn't good enough was because the arrest information was just that. It was arrest information. There was no conviction. It was vague and outdated, I believe, was some of the language used. It was a close case, but it was still.
Counsel, I'm not sure that's correct. I'm looking at paragraph 22 of Eason, and it reflects that Eason had been arrested 14 times, and of those 14, three involved obstructing arrests and two assaults. And the court says in paragraph 2, while those three obstructing and two assault arrests may have involved violence. There are no specifics indicating as such. We do not know where those arrests took place or whether she was ever convicted. Now I get to the important part. And thus cannot determine whether violence was an element of those alleged crimes. Well, when I look at the arrests here, armed robbery and murder, well, granted, just like in Eason, I don't know about the convictions, that's enough to make me nervous that there might be violence, but you're telling me that's not enough as part of the totality of circumstances, the other things that I can't consider murder and armed robbery. Or shouldn't give it much weight, I guess is more accurate what you're saying. It's part of the totality of circumstances, but shouldn't have much weight. Boy, I think that that would cause me to sit up straight.
They can and should be considered, but again, what weight to assign to it in this specific case, going back to the facts in the case at hand, we had an initial encounter, a very uneventful one. Before he, Trooper Gordon, even knew about these arrests, there was nothing, there was shaking hands, but other than that, there is nothing to indicate any level of hostility or dangerousness.
Let me be more specific. In my reference to paragraph 22 of Eason, I said, the court said, indicated, and thus cannot determine whether violence was an element of those alleged crimes. Is it okay for me to conclude that violence was an element of those alleged crimes when I refer to the crimes of murder and armed robbery?
Certainly murder and armed robbery would at least have the threat.
You know, we have a situation where he's speeding. Everyone agrees. The officer activates his lights. It's a March evening, about 9:37, so it's dark, right? He's weaving within the lane, and the officer observes that he moves his shoulder and arm up and down and says it looked like he was stuffing something underneath the seat or under his foot area. He goes up to the car. You keep saying there was nothing other than handshaking, but to me, all those things sort of factor in here, weaving, trying to stick something under the seat, and you go up to the car, and at least I thought the testimony was he was very nervous and his hands were shaking. Now, people could be nervous for a variety of reasons. But then the officer goes back and he runs his record and finds out he has previous arrests anyway for murder, false imprisonment, robbery, and a pending charge for drugs. If I understand you correctly, you're saying the officer, if those were convictions for murder and false imprisonment, this would be a different analysis. You'd agree there's reasonable suspicion to frisk. But, or if they were pending even, there'd be reasonable suspicion to frisk. But since they were just arrests, there isn't reasonable suspicion. I'm trying to figure out what it is we tell officers that they can and cannot do. What's the rule?
One is to have some duty to inquire, I believe. We had arrest information that was given to the officer. He waited for backup to arrive, and he didn't inquire further.
Let me start at the top. If it were a conviction, could he have frisked him, given these facts? Murder, false imprisonment, robbery?
If there were convictions, would reasonable suspicion exist?
Yes.
Most likely, yes.
If they were pending charges, would reasonable suspicion exist?
Not necessarily. I think you still need to look at everything in the totality of the circumstances.
So absent the officer confirming, I'm figuring out what the rule is that you're asking us to adopt. Absent the officer confirming that there's a conviction for dangerous offenses, there's no reasonable suspicion to frisk unless there are extraneous factors that otherwise would authorize him to do so.
If there were other factors, it could reach that level, but I don't believe under the current law, reasonable suspicion would exist even on pending charges. If there is more information in the record, possibly.
But officers can frisk people. They can have reasonable suspicion to, you know, do a safety check. I mean, there are other things besides someone's record. Someone could have no record, but that wouldn't, I mean, there could be reasons an officer still is going to frisk somebody.
Right. Okay. Correct.
There is an arrest in North Dakota?
Correct.
And an arrest in Minnesota?
Correct. We were given two states to go with the arrest history.
So, is that significant?
I think it goes to the number of different times he was arrested, and someone could be arrested on multiple charges at one time. I think I put my count at a minimum of three because we had three different states where he was arrested in the past. But we're dealing with a 26-year-old individual who, you know, we're talking about being arrested for very serious felonies. I think a reasonable inference to draw that he was free and in a different state was that he was not convicted of those, that he very well may have been innocent. The age of him is very relevant and would have been on his driver's license and was readily available for the officer. Had the officer even, you know, ran the license plate, learned about these arrests after seeing that movement, we'd be under a different circumstance. I believe it's significant that he approached the vehicle and had that initial encounter and had a, again, other than the shaking hand, an uneventful conversation. There was no signs of hostility, no signs of deception. The officer could have inquired about the movement. The court has noted in Johnson it has been significant that there's a lot to learn from asking a question. Even if the person lies, you can see their demeanor and the way they answered. It would all go to reasonable suspicion if, depending on how he answered. The officer in this case didn't even inquire. He returned to his cruiser, waited for backup, did not write a ticket, did not inquire with dispatch. He presumably was watching the Mr. Buchanan during this time and noted again nothing suspicious while he waited for backup to arrive. There's nothing in the record that when they did approach that they approached with guns drawn. They asked him to exit the vehicle. Again, very cooperative, exited the vehicle. The officer doesn't remember how he positioned him afterwards, but they did complete a frisk at that time. I believe all of that is very significant in analyzing the totality of the circumstances in this case. The state did not put in other facts. The balance starts with the protection of the individual, where the state has the burden of proof to provide these specific and articulable facts that the officer observed to warrant the intrusion. In this state, we have mandatory arrest statutes for domestic situations. We have people who may be observed doing something inappropriately, they get arrested. It's very, I don't know how common, but it happens where the person arrested may actually be the victim or may be completely innocent. And if we rely just on an arrest record, these individuals who are wrongly arrested could potentially be subject to more frequent searches, more frequent frisks based solely on their arrest records every time they're stopped for speeding or an equipment violation on their vehicle. There's numerous reasons people get stopped. Sometimes they're intentionally doing wrong. Sometimes it's just a malfunction. But I don't believe individuals should suffer based on arrests and officers, although they can consider arrests. I see my time is up. May I finish?
You may complete your thought.
While officers may consider a person's arrest record in the totality of the circumstances, we must look at all of the facts of the case, and if the officer can inquire, they should inquire to find out more information to see if it is more than just an arrest. Thank you.
If there's, do you use the same argument for frisking the car? In other words, if you say that the person could be frisked, that does that mean the car can be frisked?
I believe case law does support that as the individual would likely be returning to the car, and it's just the area within their reach, though that could be frisked.
Okay. Does it show how far he was from the car at any one time?
During the frisk of the individual, Mr. Buchanan was brought to the back of the car. I believe he was actually placed in a squad car for a brief period of time when they were conducting the frisk of the vehicle.
But he could return to the car and then have a gun and be in dangerous.
If the ticket had been written, he would have been returning to his car. Yes.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, Justice Prosser?
I think that you are suggesting that the officer, having the knowledge that there had been some prior arrests, should have asked something like this: "Mr. Buchanan, we have a record that you have been arrested for murder." Or how would you ask the question? How should the officer have asked the question?
To Mr. Buchanan?
No.
He could have had him step out of the vehicle and asked him. I think the more significant question that the officer should have inquired about is the movement during the initial stop. But he could have had him step out of the car. I think the officer could have inquired with dispatch and found out more without necessarily having to talk to Mr. Buchanan himself, but at that time backup had arrived, and he could have certainly have asked Mr. Buchanan. But I think with a 26-year-old on murder charge, or murder arrest, I should say, it's not even known whether he was charged, it's a reasonable inference to say he wasn't convicted. And I think that leads to the officer maybe questioning the information he had or wanted to find out more, and he should have inquired at that point. He didn't even inquire whether bail conditions existed on this pending charges if he was traveling out of state, which is a common bail condition not to leave the state of Wisconsin.
What county was that pending charge?
That is not in the record.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thomas J. Balestrieri, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Balestrieri.
Thank you, Your Honor. To start with, I do have to make a correction in my statement of facts. I got a little carried away with this case. I've never had a case like this before in the Supreme Court. And I think that I pushed it a little bit when I said that Mr. Buchanan's, not only were Mr. Buchanan's hands shaking when the officer first encountered him, but that his voice was cracking. While the record shows clearly that Mr. Buchanan's voice was cracking somewhat later in this confrontation, it does not clearly establish that his voice was cracking at the time that the officer first encountered him. So I'm withdrawing that.
Any other part of your brief you'd like to withdraw since you're kind of on a roll?
No. But I would like to withdraw something from my opponent's argument while we're talking about withdrawing.
You have.
The record does show rather clearly that Officer Gordon not only did a computer check on the computer in his car, but he also contacted dispatch to try to get some additional information. And he testified on the record that neither his computer nor his dispatcher were able to provide any additional information regarding Mr. Buchanan's prior arrests. So he had to go with what he knew, which in this case, at least as far as the prior arrests are concerned, wasn't a whole lot. But it was something, it was, as you pointed out earlier, it was something more than the officers had in the Eason case, because at least in this case, the officers knew that the prior arrests were for violent crimes, or at least in the case of the false imprisonment, maybe not violent, but at least something involving an element of force. So we at least have that in this case that we didn't have in the Eason case. I got to tell you that I was so enthused about this case that I actually went up to Osseo to put myself in the position of this trooper at milepost 87 to see what the lay of the land was about. So if anybody has any questions.
But we don't do facts here, Counselor, so I think you'll just pass on that offer. I hope you went to Norske Nook while you were in Osseo.
I didn't go to the Norske Nook this time, but I've gone to the Norske Nook previously.
Just want all the facts.
No, I'm actually joking here a little bit about going up there for the specific purpose of checking out this case.
I would suppose so, because I think that that signpost would be the same as many others in that area.
Yeah, I actually
traveled it many times.
Actually, I was traveling. I have a daughter, like Mr. Buchanan, who lives in the Twin Cities. I was going up to visit her. It just so happened that it was the same time that I was writing this brief, so I did a little checking on the way up.
But you're not going to testify here?
No.
Okay.
But just if you have some questions.
All right.
I'll be happy to answer them. Anyway, what we have to do in these cases is, it's a two-step analysis. First step in the analysis is that we have to consider the factors individually and see what those factors are like, what the content of the information is, what weight we should give those factors individually. And then the second step is to consider them together in the totality of the circumstances. Now,
and what are we looking for? What's the goal here?
The goal we are looking for is reason to suspect that the person who was stopped in this vehicle out on the highway might have a weapon. Not that he has a weapon beyond a reasonable doubt, not that he has a weapon more probably than not, but that he might possibly have a weapon. That's the reasonable suspicion standard.
This is a Terry stop? Doesn't matter. I withdraw that. Go ahead.
Okay. This is less than beyond a reasonable doubt. It's less than probable cause. It's only some articulable reason to believe that the person who is stopped has a weapon.
And it's to protect the officer.
To protect the officer, right. We're not looking for evidence of a crime here. If we're looking for evidence of a crime, you can do a search of the car if you've got probable cause to believe there are drugs in the car.
Okay.
Nobody is suggesting that there was probable cause to conduct a search for drugs in this
case.
So
the same reasonable suspicion relates to the car.
Right.
We have to look for a weapon. We're looking for a weapon.
We're looking for a weapon. We're not looking for drugs. We're looking for a weapon. There's no suggestion in this case that Officer Gordon was looking for drugs, although that certainly plays into the analysis. It's part of the analysis. It's part of the totality of the circumstances, but it's not the end of the analysis. We're not suggesting that Officer Gordon could be looking for drugs.
I want to hear your analysis very much, but why should the officer have been concerned about a weapon?
Well, it's the totality of the circumstances. The first is, you know, we look at the fact that Mr. Buchanan was making a furtive movement.
Yeah, but what I'm really trying to get at is this defendant has been arrested for speeding. There really isn't any question about it.
No, he was speeding.
He was speeding.
He was speeding.
Okay, so he knows he's going to get a speeding ticket. Why would he use a weapon under those circumstances, even if he had one?
Well, and this is my kind of two-part analysis.
Okay.
What the cop knew individually and what the cop knew collectively. Initially, when Mr. Buchanan was stopped for speeding, and the only thing Mr. Buchanan knew was that he was stopped for speeding, there was no reason for him to use a weapon at that point. But the officer goes back, does a check, a record check. Mr. Buchanan now has reason to think, oh, this officer now knows that I was arrested for possession of marijuana with intent to deliver just a couple weeks earlier in this same area by another state patrol officer. That puts the whole situation in a different light from Mr. Buchanan's perspective, because we now know, of course, after the fact, that he was carrying marijuana. He had like 40 grams of it in his car. So he knows he's got marijuana. Now he has reason to think that the officer knows that he was arrested for carrying marijuana just a couple weeks earlier in the same general area. Now he thinks, uh-oh, maybe I'm going to be arrested again for my second marijuana offense in a couple of weeks. That gives him some reason to want to use a gun.
Now, look. Traffic stops are one of the most dangerous things for an officer.
Yes, and I provided some statistics to the court on that.
We've had any number of cases where it's a traffic stop and a frisk, and the whole issue is reasonable suspicion. It seems to me every time an officer stops a citizen, or stops a member of the public, I should say, the officer runs the risk of being hurt, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. But the officer does not have the right to search everyone who is stopped.
I would certainly hope not.
Okay.
I would not want to be searched if I was stopped.
So you have to have reasonable suspicion to search. Now, what is the reasonable suspicion here? Is it that Buchanan knows what this officer's computer says from Minnesota and Michigan? I don't know how many people know what a Wisconsin computer can tell.
He probably, I wouldn't say he knows that.
That's right. It seems that it's what the officer knows. So I'm somewhat surprised by your answer to Justice Prosser about what Buchanan knows and that he might have a motive to use a weapon. That's really what I heard you say.
Right, and I limited my answer to the prior drug arrest on that highway.
So it seems to me that the question here is furtive movements. Some cases said furtive movements, good enough for suspicion, right? Then you have here nervousness. We have cases that say, oh, nervousness, over and above normal nervousness, reasonable grounds for suspicion. Put the two together, furtive movements and nervousness, reasonable suspicion. Now we got a third issue here, and that's what the officer. We're concentrating, aren't we, on what the officer believes?
Yes, we are.
Yeah, okay. So the arrest record tells the officer that this guy may have been involved with force, right?
There is some reason to think that, yeah.
That's right, some reason, right?
Yep.
And isn't that your case?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that your case? I've just made your case, haven't I? What have I left out?
I actually not very much.
That's right, you ought to take it. Okay. So that's what the reasonable suspicion is. When you make the stop, you don't have necessarily a suspicion that's going to justify a frisk. You've got to have something more than all of us are dangerous out there to cops.
Sure.
Okay.
Right.
So the question is this arrest record good enough?
Not by itself. And I've never contended that.
Okay. So is it good enough in the totality of circumstances?
Everything included together, yes.
All right.
And in particular, now, we have two different categories of arrests here.
Well, that's another thing. When was he arrested? Was he arrested for speeding?
On the prior drug charge?
Here, in this case, was he arrested for speeding?
He was not arrested.
No, he was just taken out of the car. When was he arrested in this case?
After they found the drugs.
Right. So that's very important, because the question that was asked to you is when he was arrested for speeding, but he wasn't arrested for speeding. Okay, so we have all of this reasonable suspicion before an arrest, and the arrest isn't being challenged per se because there's probable cause. It's being challenged because the probable cause may not be good because of the search, right?
Right.
Okay.
That's right.
All right. So where does that leave us? Let's talk about the drug charge. What about, didn't we have a case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court, Richards, which said that drugs cannot be equated by this court to money and arms?
Not automatically.
Pardon me?
Not automatically.
Not automatically. Okay.
But okay. Cases from this court subsequent to Richards have reemphasized that drugs and guns, while they don't inevitably go together, often go together. And we're only talking reasonable suspicion in this case. So we don't have to say beyond a reasonable doubt, this guy was arrested as a drug dealer, therefore he had a gun. We don't have to say that. That's all we have to say is this guy was arrested as a drug dealer, therefore there is some reason to believe he had a gun.
What about the concept that an arrest does not mean guilt? Right?
Well, it doesn't mean guilt.
Okay. So it's still good, even though that you have a presumption of innocence. Don't you?
I'm sorry. There is a presumption of innocence, right? But to a certain extent, that presumption is, I won't say overcome, but at least there are some inroads made on that presumption by the fact that there was an arrest, which means that at least somebody thought there was probable cause to believe he committed the crime. Now, probable cause to believe he committed the crime doesn't carry the same weight as proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed the crime, but it's still got some weight, and it still is entitled to some consideration by the officer. You know, interestingly enough, we just had a case here, well, we still have a case here in Madison that made the papers last week, of a guy who was arrested for murder back in 1989, and the charges were dismissed, not because he was innocent, but because the principal witness, who happened to be the suspect's wife, vanished and couldn't be found. Well, she got found, and those charges are now reinstated against the guy. So, you know, an arrest, while it doesn't mean that the guy is guilty, the fact that you don't have a conviction following the arrest doesn't necessarily mean he's innocent either. It's very ambiguous, and that's the essence of reasonable suspicion. Ambiguity. We don't know. It could be this, it could be that, it could be something else.
So which of these arrests are most important in this case?
The arrest that's most important is the drug arrest, by far. The drug arrest a couple of weeks earlier.
Recent.
I'm sorry?
Recent.
Yes, recent. Okay. Oh, yeah. So whatever that drug arrest says about Mr. Buchanan and the possibility that he might have a weapon is very fresh information. The information is as good now when he's stopped by Officer Gordon as it was a couple of weeks ago. It's not something that happened in the past, and maybe all kinds of things have happened in between. This is very fresh information.
Counsel, let's say, assuming arguendo, there is no reasonable suspicion. The trial court here didn't decide on reasonable suspicion, but decided on plain view. And I think the facts, as characterized by the trial court anyway, are that the officer's testimony was that he just leaned in the car, had a flashlight, and saw it. That's from Appendix 142. What about this leaning in, and how far can you lean in without reasonable suspicion?
You can't lean in at all without reasonable suspicion.
And so it's your position that if there is no reasonable suspicion, that this cannot be sustained on plain view?
Well, the officer testified in the two different things. One is the way he actually found the drugs, or he actually found that marijuana stem, which led him to the other drugs. He opened the door of the car. He did lean in, no question about it. He used his flashlight, incidentally, which is not a constitutional problem. Using a flashlight is enhancing the senses, doesn't exacerbate the nature of the search. But then he found this marijuana stem between the console and the front seat. That's what he testified to as far as how he actually found that marijuana stem. Then a separate question was kind of a hypothetical question that was posed to him, and that was, well, could you have seen this marijuana stem even if you hadn't entered the car? And his answer to that was yes.
Let me just focus on this a little bit. Again, I read from Appendix 142 and the court's characterization of the testimony was that the officer's testimony was that he just leaned in and had the flashlight and saw it. So that's his characterization. On the next page of the appendix, 143, he gets to perhaps a hypothetical, and it says, as Mr. Niemer indicated, it was in plain view. He would have seen it in daylight conditions. So based on that, I wouldn't even have to get to the other issue of reasonable suspicion. But as I read the judge's opinion, that part of it anyway, it seems to me that he took the testimony to be that it was 9:37 at night, he had a flashlight, he leaned in, had the flashlight, and saw it. Without leaning in at 9:37 at night and with a flashlight, I don't know. All I know is what was said here. And what was said here...
And as I said, there are two different parts to the officer's testimony. One is what he actually did, lean in. Mm-hmm. The other is hypothetically what he could have done or might have done, and that is that he could have seen the marijuana without leaning in.
Yeah, but I look at what the court apparently relied on. I mean, my best assessment, it may be incorrect, my best assessment of what the court relied on is on page 142. The officer's testimony was that he leaned in and had the flashlight and saw it, and that was plain view. And I'm not sure that if that's the judge's characterization of it, and if that's a correct characterization of it, if that complies with the law, if assuming no reasonable suspicion. I mean, you had indicated you can't lean in.
Can't lean in, no. No, you cannot enter the car without some justification, either reasonable suspicion or probable cause. If you enter the car, you're invading territory that you have no right to invade unless you've got reasonable suspicion or if you're searching for a weapon, or probable cause if you're searching for evidence of a crime. And I'm not contesting that.
I mean, I think the second issue, at least as I see it here, was whether or not the trial court erred in determining that it was plain view. That is an issue.
I don't think that's even an issue in the case.
Well, it's because you think there's reasonable suspicion and you don't have to get to it. That's why
I don't
think it's an issue.
If there's reasonable suspicion and he had a right to do the frisk of the car. Now, the frisk of the car doesn't require him just to frisk for things that are in plain view. He can go into hidden compartments. He can go into the glove compartment, for example, to doing a frisk. Guns are often hidden in glove compartments, so he can go in there. He can go under the seat.
Problem is the trial court didn't do the reasonable suspicion analysis, so it just relied on the plain view.
I know.
Was the state willing to rely on that?
I'm sorry?
Is the state willing to rely on the concept that if there is if there's no reasonable suspicion here, the search was good anyway of the car because it was in plain view?
No, I'm not willing to rely on that because I have not made that argument.
That's what I'm asking.
And the reason I have not made that argument is because, as I said in answering Justice Bradley's question, the officer's testimony regarding plain view was purely hypothetical. The officer did not see the marijuana from outside the car. He saw it from inside the car. That's the fact.
We have had a rules hearing on expungement of Wisconsin records, where people who have been arrested came to the court and said, people are using these records for all sorts of things, jobs, dating, etc. And then if someone's arrested and nothing is done, what? And you can pick the number of years, that should be removed from the record so it can't be used against them. And that using arrest records or dismissal of criminal actions against them violates state statutes that protect people who have arrest records, and et cetera. And yet now the court has not acted on that petition, but the legislature is considering expungement of particular records. We don't know what they'll do. But now the state is coming in and saying, oh, it's perfectly okay to use these records.
I think, as I understand the position of law enforcement on the issue that you have raised, is that these should not be expunged.
That's right. That's my understanding.
And for this very reason.
That's why
because
I'm raising
they do
it.
Provide the officer out there on the road with some information that's very helpful to him in deciding whether he needs to do something to protect himself. So, I mean, while I tend to agree that some of these arrest records have been abused by people other than law enforcement for purposes that have nothing to do with law enforcement, and while it might be a good idea to limit the access of people other than law enforcement officers, as a person who is involved in the criminal justice system on behalf of law enforcement officers, I have to agree with them wholeheartedly. These things should not be kept from law enforcement officers.
Well,
keep them from everybody else, that's fine. Not the cops.
Law enforcement's had NCIC, CIB. They've had a variety of tools that the public may not have right at their disposal. So, you know, whether or not there's an adjustment to CCAP doesn't impact law enforcement's ability to do their job, does
well,
it? I mean, law enforcement's been doing their job
before
CCAP. As
long as whatever adjustments you make to CCAP don't also make adjustments to NCIC and the time system.
Your opposing counsel suggests that the officer should have asked some follow-up questions about some of the things that the Minnesota and North Dakota. Do you have a response to that?
Well, I don't see any reason why the officer should do that. The officer doesn't have to take these answers as a verity. He can almost assume that a person who has something to hide is going to lie. And in this case, we have actual proof of that because when the officer did ask Buchanan, do you have any drugs or guns in the car, Buchanan said, no, I don't, when in fact he did. And the officer asked him again after finding the marijuana stem, do you have any more marijuana in the car? Buchanan said, no, and in fact he had 40 grams of it. So what's the point of asking him if the guy's just going to lie anyway? Is the officer, if the person who was stopped lies, is the officer at his peril supposed to take this lie as a verity? I don't think so.
Could you restate once more? I thought you said of the total sort of record that came to the officer, you thought the most important one was the recent drug arrest.
Yes, I did.
And why is that?
Well, it was fresh information. It was in the same vicinity. It was an arrest made by an officer from the same, state trooper, the same law enforcement agency. It was made on the highway, just like this one was. And the fact that it was an arrest for possession of marijuana with intent to deliver raised this inference that Mr. Buchanan was a drug dealer and that he might be carrying a gun because he was a drug dealer. That's why I think that was important. It's all of those facts about the arrest put together sound a lot like this guy might have a gun.
And he, the officer, knew all of those things?
Yes. Yeah. That's what he testified to. It's what he said he knew. And we have to take that as a verity. It's what he said he knew.
You know, we had a case, and maybe you'll remember it, where the testimony was that this interstate highway between the Twin Cities and Wisconsin, and maybe points east, was the delivery route for drugs.
I don't know if we had a case that says that, but I think it's fairly common knowledge that
it is. But that was the testimony of the officer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's fairly common knowledge that there's a drug trafficking route from Chicago up to the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm. That was the Badger Stop case.
That was the Badger Stop. That was my recollection of
District 3 Court of Appeals.
Yeah, I don't think we do Badger Stops anymore.
Pardon me?
I don't think we do Badger Stops anymore.
Well, we don't call them that.
But at any rate, I think it's fairly well known that a lot of drugs go between Chicago and the Twin Cities, right up, I-90 to Madison and then 94 up to the Twin Cities.
That's the case I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Our red light is on. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Balistrieri. Mr. Whitman.
Thank you. My colleague focused a lot on whether or not Mr. Buchanan had a weapon. But there's another factor to the analysis, and that's whether he was also dangerous. If we focus just on solely whether a person had a weapon, we'd be searching or frisking everyone in November in Wisconsin who's a deer hunter dressed in orange or who has a Ducks Unlimited or Whitetail or Browning stamp in the back of their vehicle. I'm from Ashland. We have a lot of people who drive around with weapons that time of year. I don't think they get to search.
That you have a constitutional right?
It is a constitutional right under both the federal and state, and in fact, the right to hunt is actually a constitutional right.
Are you aware of how hunters have to keep their weapons in their vehicles in order to be transporting them legally?
Encased. But they can put them in the trunk of their vehicle. They can have them in their back seat. They can have them in the front seat as long as they're cased. So there is a level of dangerousness that also must go into this analysis. And we can look at what someone did in the past or may have done. We don't know what he did. There may be hints of what may have happened. But we have to look at this moment in time. One, is he armed? Two, is he dangerous at this specific moment? And in doing that, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances. In referring to facts I deem irrelevant to the analysis, but that fact that Mr. Buchanan lied to the officer after the marijuana was discovered, there are things that can be seen from his demeanor, though, that just the asking of the question can show. Even if the person lies, there was increased nervousness when Mr. Buchanan was asked. There was a cracking voice. There is a lot of things that can be learned. If that was asked earlier, it could have certainly provided clues to the reasonable suspicion analysis, regardless of whether the answer was truthful. Officers are typically trained to make full observations of both a person's body language and their voice, any other deceptions that they might also detect. I'd like to also talk about the plain view issue. I believe we're in agreement that if there was no reasonable suspicion, the stem was not in plain view. If, you know, even going by what the trial court said, that he could have seen it from outside, well, all he would have seen would be a half-inch plant stem on the floor of a car. I don't think that's indicative of contraband. I think the plain view analysis that reached the probable cause also had the raw odor of marijuana, which was only obtained by entering the vehicle. So if we do look at the reasonable or the plain view analysis, I think without reasonable suspicion, the plain view, it's clear it was not plain view, unless he could be in the car.
Your opposing counsel stresses the recent arrest on a drug violation. It says that is the most important of all the things in the record. What's your response to that?
Well, it certainly is the one that we had the most information on. I mean, we knew it was a couple weeks prior, but we don't know any more about it. I don't know how much you can draw about a person's current conduct for something that even happened a couple weeks prior when it's a speeding stop, but it certainly is the most fresh one because it is recent. Even if he was guilty, he likely would not be in jail at that time, unlike the other ones, which were much more serious, and him being a young man being free. So there is more to it that can be reasonably inferred. With the disposition, though, of that case or even the priors, the officer even said, I have his quote here, the court dispositions didn't concern me on the road. It's officer safety factors of what he's done in the past. The officer didn't care much other than that he was arrested. He didn't want to inquire. So there should be a duty on an officer, though, to inquire somewhat. When it is just an arrest information, he didn't even inquire as to what bond conditions may have existed for a person facing a pending charge, a person who was, he was advised, was leaving the state of Wisconsin. He could have checked to see if there was a bond condition not to leave the state of Wisconsin. That certainly would have raised red flags. But if it was a pending charge, presumably there was some sort of at least a signature bond or cash bond because it was a felony delivery charge. But there was no inquiry, so again, weight should be given to it. How much, though, I believe is the main question for this court. And I see my time is up, if I may finish.
Yes, you may.
The question is how much weight should be given to it. We have, again, vague information. There should be some, but when we look at this case and the totality of the circumstances, the fact that there was no trying to flee from the cop, there was a casual encounter, very uneventful, there was time, there was backup. It just doesn't raise the level of reasonable suspicion where the person should be intruded upon with a frisk, a physical touching of their person, and then the vehicle frisk of going through their personal belongings.
So, what's the state's burden here?
Clear and convincing evidence.
That the warrantless arrest was constitutional.
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wickman, and thank you, Mr. Balistrieri, for yet another case involving reasonable suspicion to frisk, and especially in cars and persons in cars. So that concludes our hearing in 09-AP-2934-CR, State versus Deandra A. Buchanan. The court will be in recess from now until 1:30 when it will hear its third case today. And if the students can remain, I shall be out in a few moments and we shall discuss our procedures. The court's in recess.